The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Vale Inco, growing together.
And joining us now on the debate, in Cincinnati, Ohio, Tim Melley, professor of English at Miami University. And here in studio, Jordan Peterson, clinical psychologist at the University of Toronto, and Steve Bailey, professor at York University. I want to start, of course, by welcoming you both here, and of course, Tim on the line down from Ohio. The number one Google video today is something called Zeitgeist. It is a film that answers the questions about what Christianity, 9/11, and the Federal Reserve all have in common, and you may not like the answers. Let's play a little clip of this, and then we'll come back and talk. Michael, roll tape, please.
The more you begin to investigate what we think we understand, where we came from, what we think we're doing, the more you begin to see we've been lied to. We've been lied to by every institution. What makes you think for 1 minute that the religious institution is the only one that's never been touched? The religious institutions of this world are at the bottom of the dirt. The religious institutions in this world are put there by the same people who gave you your government, your corrupt education, to set up your international banking cartels, because our masters don't give a damn about you or your family. All they care about is what they have always cared about, and that's controlling the whole damn world.
That's just a short snippet of Zeitgeist. It's actually 2 hours long. It's highly watchable, very good special effects in the thing. But the gist of it is, everything you ever knew in your life was a lie. Your government is lying to you. Your financial institutions are lying to you. Your religions are lying to you. And everything is done in the service of hidden powers. Tim, I want you to get us started by telling us, what does the popularity of Zeitgeist tell you about the spirit of our times?
Well, there have always been conspiracy theories, and I know mostly about the history of American culture, and certainly there have been conspiracy theories in the U.S. since the beginning of the country, but they have become incredibly popular recently, and I think Zeitgeist is a great example of what you see in a lot of these theories. First of all, in my view, a lot of them act as a kind of social theory. They actually, their authors or their inventors are trying to theorize how power works in our society. And so in a lot of these kinds of theories, you see a sense that the author of the theory or the people that the theory is about are disempowered. Power has been displaced upward to some sort of giant social agency, organization, system. Sometimes it's a specific organization like the CIA. Other times it's something incredibly vague, like the New World Order, or the system, or them. And I want to just point to one thing that Barry Zwicker mentioned in his comments, which I think is true, and that's that the sense of conspiracy has changed a little. Conspiracy comes from the Latin meaning conspire, which means to breathe with. And originally, the sense was of a small group of plotters engaged in a contained plot. Now the sense of conspiracy almost is almost always about some sort of vast, malevolent, vague system. And I think the film gives a fantastic example of that tendency.
Steve Bailey, pick up on that. What kind of person in particular is attracted to the message of Zeitgeist?
Well, I think what's interesting about Zeitgeist is it's a kind of one-stop shop for conspiracies. So it has casts a pretty broad net. You have, as you mentioned, you have an economic conspiracy, you have a religious conspiracy, and you have a geopolitical conspiracy. So in that sense, it casts a pretty wide net. And in fact, it casts an even wider net because, of course, it's available on, through the internet. So close to 1 billion people have, at least theoretically, have access to it. So with that large potential audience, I think it can carve out a pretty nice following. And I think it's good for people who have a natural suspicion of the media, which I think is often a very healthy thing. In this case, I think it's channeled in some perhaps unhealthy directions. But I think anyone with skepticism is a potential audience member for this film.
It's interesting, though. They tell us that anything longer than 2 minutes as a clip on the internet, people haven't got patience for. This thing is 2 hours, and it's been downloaded more than anything else on the web. That says something, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And it's a very, very slick production, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. What's doubly amazing, though, is that it could have been made on a home computer.
Mm-hmm.
The technology now is so user-friendly and so widely available that an individual with literally a laptop could have made that film. There's not much live footage, so it's all toasted together from mm-hmm. video clips.
Tim told us a moment ago that conspiracies do rise and fall, the popularity of them. And I want to bring up another graphic here. And again, you can find all this stuff on Google to indicate how much or little the general public has bought into conspiracy theories over the last number of years. Can we bring this up, Michael, here? This is, we're going to start with just this century. The actual Google graphic does go back about 500 years, but let's just look at this century. Strangely enough, at the turn of the last century, not that much. However, if you look at the word conspiracy in all of the media of the time, you can see as you get towards the end of the last century and the beginning of this one, an enormous spike. We seem to be remarkably much more preoccupied with conspiracies over the last, 10, 15 years or so than we were in the previous 90. Jordan, what's the explanation in your view for that?
Well, I think part of it has to do with 9/11. And
but
the
it
economic...
predates 9/11.
Yeah, well, maybe some of it has to do also with the rise of media that's not quite as sophisticated or critical as media was in the past. And so that would partly be the rise of access to popular media like the internet, but also perhaps the decrease in credibility of standard news sources and the probability that they're going to make a lot out of nothing. There's an example of that that's quite obvious, too, which is that people also vastly overestimate how dangerous their cities are now, despite the fact that the crime rate has been falling, because the rate at which the media has been covering violent crimes has been going up very rapidly, as the crime rate has been falling. So,
is there something in us that's inherent or natural that wants to believe in conspiracy theories?
Well, you know, it was funny because you said when you were talking just a few minutes ago about the they that say that people will only watch a video for 2 minutes. And there was a philosopher named Heidegger who noted that a standard part of human experience was the experience of the they. And the they is the people who think whatever it is that they think. And you could think of that as, because we're such social creatures, that we're very, very sensitive to the idea that we're constantly being watched and evaluated by the social group. And we have a verbal shorthand for that, which is the they. So that sort of exists out there as the people that are always evaluating us and watching and perhaps, and this is where the conspiracy theories start to come in, plotting. Now, people also need completion. Like, ever since human beings have been around, they've had totalizing theories. I mean, mostly those were religious theories. And in a religious theory, there's an explanation for everything. Well, when those sorts of explanations start to fall apart, what you get as a consequence isn't a rise in rationalism like people like Richard Dawkins might presume, but a proliferation of alternative theories about everything that have never been subjected to critical evaluation or to historical winnowing.
Here's a perfect example, and Tim, I'll get you to comment on this. We've got a graphic here that asks the question, on the issue of 9/11, is the current president of the United States, George W. Bush, telling the truth? 16% of the people said yes, according to a New York Times CBS News poll of a couple of years ago. How about, is George W. Bush hiding something? 53% said yes, he's hiding something. 28% say he's mostly lying. 3% aren't sure. 81% of your fellow Americans, Tim, are not buying the official story on 9/11. What's the explanation in your view for that?
I think there are a number of things. I mean, just to pick up on what Jordan said, there are a number of psychologists and psychiatrists over the last century that have pointed out that all human thinking is akin to paranoia in some ways. But I think I'd like to answer the question by looking at a number of social developments that have happened really since the Cold War that I think contribute to a culture that kind of encourages this sort of thinking. One of them is the development of what I call the covert sphere of government. This is the surveillance agencies, the clandestine agencies that are always working on behalf of the nation, but in secret. And their existence is an open secret. We all know that they're doing something. We don't know what they're doing. And that puts our government in a position where it has to be openly deceptive about some of the things that it's doing. And that feeds into all kinds of suspicions about what's really going on behind the scenes. That's one thing. Another thing is simply the rise of mass culture. It's actually relatively new that we get most of our news through mass communication devices. And one of the things that that does is it actually, media actually mediate between us, between our senses and the world. And so a lot of the information we get now, and we get more and more information, comes at us from a great distance. And that, I think, also introduces a difficulty, a kind of a distrust or suspicion about the sources of knowledge in our world. And then the final thing I would just like to mention is that since World War II, a number of influential sociologists and social theorists have started to express the idea that human beings are far less autonomous than we used to think they were, that social agencies and institutions control our behavior and our thinking much more than we thought they did, say, 50 or 100 years ago. And those mainstream ways of thinking actually help encourage some of the tendencies that you see in conspiracy theory.
Gotcha. Let me welcome to our debate as well, joining us now on the line from Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, Ian Dobigan, who's a historian at the University of Prince Edward Island. And Ian, let me put you to work right away. You've written a book with the title Suspicious Minds. It's a book about the kind of people, I guess, who made Zeitgeist, the number one film on Google at the moment. Tell us what it means to have a quote-unquote suspicious mind.
Well, when you've got a suspicious mind, you tend to look at the evidence, but you also tend to look beyond the evidence, beyond everyday life and the signs and sounds of everyday life. You're always gripped by the story behind the scene, and so you're not satisfied with the evidence. You want to know what the real truth is, as the movie Zeitgeist says, what the real truth is behind the facade, behind the sounds that we see. So that's what constitutes a suspicious mind, for the most part.
And can we get into some of your theories as to why you believe so many people are unwilling to believe that sometimes a cigar really is just a cigar?
Well, we live in millennial times. I think our guests have already talked about that a little bit. People believe they're living in an apocalyptic age when there's a great struggle between good on the one hand and evil on the other. So it's easy to start imagining history as a colossal struggle between one group and another group, one group that oppresses another group. We also live in a time of an age of digital technology, the internet, where rumors can spread like with lightning-like speed around the world. And if you want to spread your own ideas, your own theories, it's very easy to do that too. We also live in a world of globalization. And with globalization, we see the boundaries between self and society gradually breaking down, so much so that people fear that their privacy is being endangered. We hear talk about identity theft. Surveillance cameras are almost everywhere. So there's these kinds of things that the average citizen notices from time to time. And we're also a more cynical people. I make a big distinction between being skeptical, which Barry Zwicker says he is, and cynical. And I think cynicism helps to feed into a suspicious mind and helps to foster paranoia. Because, again, when you're cynical, you never accept what you're being told is the truth. You never accept anything that's being told, especially if it's a politician. So you're always trying to decode or deconstruct what the politician, what the figure in authority is saying. And then, of course, we've had events in recent years, events that not just 9/11, of course. We've had the Montreal massacre, the shooting at Virginia Tech. When people read about these kinds of events and see the way violence breaks into their everyday life, no wonder they feel fearful, insecure. And that's one step towards beginning to believe that there are people out there that are trying to hurt you. There are organizations, there are groups that are actively plotting and planning to do so.
Okay, let me follow up with Jordan Peterson here. I want to talk to you about a study of a group of people in New Jersey. New Jersey residents suggested that belief in conspiracies is prominent among people who are, in particular, alienated, mm-hmm. don't trust easily, mm-hmm. and are insecure about their employment. Mm-hmm. And the question is, are there that many more of those kinds of people today than there were, say, 50 or 100 years ago?
Well, I don't think that necessarily there are more people like that, but there are all these other factors that were just discussed as well. In terms of the kind of person who believes these sorts of things, we know that one of the cardinal dimensions of human personality is a trait called agreeableness. And agreeable people are warm and empathic, and disagreeable people are very skeptical and untrusting. And conspiracy theories, I think, tend to appeal to people who are low in baseline trust, so they're very skeptical about other people's motivations. They're high in neuroticism or sensitivity to negative emotion, and they're not necessarily very conscientious. And so they're looking behind the scenes for what might really be going on because they really don't think that what it is that you're saying to them is the right thing. Now, sometimes disagreeable people are right. You know, and the problem with the proliferation of media in the present manner is that we really lack critics. You know, like if you go back 20 years, if you wanted to make a public statement about virtually anything, if you wanted to write it or if you wanted to post it so 100,000 people could see it, there was a lot of barriers between you and that kind of giant access. And so you'd propound your theory, and the critics would jump on it and tear it to bits. And if it didn't sustain itself across, you know, intense questioning, it was never going to reach a mass audience. Well, now almost anything can reach a mass audience. Mm-hmm. And when something, say, like Zeitgeist is a very, very sophisticated mix of fact and fiction and very almost underhanded philosophical theorizing, it's very difficult for people to discriminate between what's true and what isn't. They just don't know enough. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me follow up with Steve. When you talk about massive communication the way we have today, and Ian referred to this as well, the Internet. Why is the way we communicate today, which obviously is different from the way we did 15, 20-plus years ago, was no email as massively as there is today, why does that matter in terms of the ability to spread communication about conspiracy theories?
It matters at two levels. First is something I mentioned before, which is just the scale of the audience. 1.1 or 1.2 billion people have some kind of internet access. That's the best guess in the world. And so you can reach those people. There's no real time barrier, instant communication. But the other thing that sometimes people overlook is just the sophistication of presentation. Mm-hmm. Someone who had a conspiracy theory before would have to perhaps create a smudgy, duplicated newsletter that they would send out that just sort of screamed kook. Now you can have a very sophisticated website with audio files, video files, digital images that provides a far more persuasive package of something that comes pretty close to mimicking mainstream media. So I think that that's a huge factor, is the accessibility not just to the audience but to the message that can be crafted in a slick and quite persuasive fashion. And I think Zeitgeist is an excellent example of that.
Jordan.
An early guest noted that increasingly, sociologists and social scientists are pointing out how influenced the individual is by their surroundings. And there's real truth in that, because it turns out that when we perceive things, the parts of the brain that we use to perceive them are also parts of the brain that we use to act. And so what that means is when you're looking at things, you're not just looking at objects in a simple way. You're looking at things that are telling you what to do. So the glass says, grab me, you know, and the TV says, look at me. And so everything is, in a sense, telling you how to act. Now, what that means is that people are always also very sensitive to the implicit messages that institutions put forward. Now, if you've gone through an airport recently, there's an implicit message that the airport is broadcasting at you. And the implicit message is there are so many people out to do harm, so many invisible people out to do harm, that even your shoes and your toothpaste are suspect. And, like, that's an institution broadcasting that message. And you hear these strange, like, meaningless utterances in airports, like the threat level is now orange, the threat level is now orange, and nobody knows what that means. They don't know what yellow means, they don't know what red means, they don't know the rules for why these things change. And all of that shouts out insecurity and paranoia. And I think it's partly that's producing this sense of ominous undercurrents.
I've got some numbers to pick up on that, and Tim and Ian, I'll get you to react to these here. What's the story with HIV? That was a question that the Washington Post posed in a poll back in 2005, and they surveyed African Americans only. What's the story with HIV? 48% thought HIV was a man-made virus. 53% believed that a cure for AIDS was being withheld from the poor. 12% believed HIV was created and spread by the CIA. 15% of those surveyed said AIDS was a form of genocide against black people. And 27% thought AIDS was produced in a government lab. Tim, how are we to understand these perceptions?
Well, I think that's a great example of some of the things that happen in conspiracy theory. First of all, if there's a central error in most conspiracy theories, it's the attribution of intention to some central malign agency. And so what you see in some of those theories about HIV is, I think, a real attempt to understand why HIV infects certain populations more than others. And that's actually a valid observation about HIV/AIDS. And it's actually a reasonable project. It's a kind of sociological project to try to figure out the complex array of social forces and economic structures and knowledge structures that actually make people in Africa more susceptible to AIDS or make certain populations more susceptible to it. Where the thinking goes another step is in imagining a sort of headquarters in which somebody cooked up this virus and actually deliberately introduced it to those populations as a way of killing millions of people. There's a fine line between the valid sociological project and the further attribution of intention to this sort of malicious agency.
Ian, there's a follow-up question here, which is, I guess conspiracy theorists believe there's two kinds of people in the world. On the one hand, there's sort of normal everyday people who want to get married, have kids, have a nice home, take a vacation once a year, have a good job, that kind of thing. And there are the other people who want to do harm to normal people and consume all the power unto themselves. Is this, you know, is this division of the world simply class struggle by another name?
Well, you could call it the new great struggle of the 21st century. We've gone through class struggle, we've gone through race struggle, and maybe this is going to define the new battle lines in the 21st century. But to get back to the case of the African American community and HIV/AIDS, I think it's distressful that these kinds of poll numbers exist. What I find even more distressful, however, is the way that some political leaders representing, claiming to represent the African American community, who give voice to these sentiments, give voice to these grievances, play at paranoid politics, as I talk about in my book. And I think that this is a distressing trend. It's not only, in other words, that paranoia, political paranoia, is grassroots. It's that it also shows up in the corridors of power, and that in some instances, in some cases, it actually makes for good political hay, good political leverage. And so we see characters who lead certain communities in society, certain political parties, who sometimes, from time to time, do voice what I would call political paranoid ideas. And I find that this is something that we should be blowing the whistle on far more than we do.
Let me get Tim in Miami University, and then Jordan to respond to that as well. This class warfare, class struggle by another name notion. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, I think a lot of conspiracy theories do operate in a sort of populist manner and imagine that power is always elsewhere. The people who articulate these theories usually imagine that someone else is controlling events. And that's true even when the person is a very powerful person, like Hillary Clinton, who famously described efforts arrayed against her husband as a vast right-wing conspiracy. I just want to go back to something that Steve Bailey said, because I thought there was an important point about the internet there that I wanted to add to, and that is one of the things that's happening is that the knowledge structures that we rely on involve a great deal of trust in other people. As our knowledge structures increasingly mediate the way that we know the world, we have to trust authority a great deal. And one of the things that's happened with the internet is that it has spread authority and it has spread authorship very broadly. Everyone's an authority, everyone's an author. My students frequently write papers where they'll cite an internet source, and it turns out when I ask them who this person actually is, that it's actually just another student at another university.
I hope you docked them marks for that.
I won't comment on that on the air. But I think you can make a nice analogy with medical knowledge that's on the web. There's a host of medical knowledge on the web, and it's wonderful that we can go on the web and try to diagnose ourselves. The problem, however, is that a lot of people misdiagnose themselves because they don't have the clinical expertise or the training to know how to interpret their symptoms in a meaningful way. And I think you see the same dynamic in conspiracy theory, when there's a wealth of information but a lack of training in how to interpret it, how to apply a sort of rigorous, rational thinking to the evidence, then you see people coming up with lots of strange theories.
Indeed. Jordan, you wanted to follow up.
Well, I was just at a conference in the southern U.S., and there was a panelist who was talking about religious ideas and the manner in which they structure themselves, and one of the things that he pointed out is that pre-literate cultures always presume an agent at work if something bad happens. So the standard human explanation for illness or drought or catastrophe of one form or another is that there's something conspiring. Now, it might be a deity, it might be an enemy, it might be a sorcerer, but it's very, very natural. Like, people very naturally animate the external world and presume that it has intention. And so all of rationalism and all of education in some ways fights against that to establish more detailed causal analysis. And another thing, and one other thing, with regards to the motivations of people who like conspiracy theories, you know, part of it is disagreeableness, for sure. But there's another part, which is that it's very comforting to know that all the reasons that the world is going to hell in a handbasket is that someone else is doing something wrong, and it's bad people. Because that means it's not you and it's not me. It's like this cabal of people that can't be trusted who've been around for 3,000 years and all they ever do is lie about everything.
Yeah,
we're off the hook. And that externalization of responsibility, I think, is part of what makes the tendency towards conspiracy theory so pathological, is that the cause of the problem is never the personal actor themselves, but somebody else who, you know, is justifiably hateable.
Steve.
Well, just let me follow up a little bit on what my colleague said. One of the biggest concerns I have is that if you look at something like Zeitgeist or other forms of conspiracy theories, they're almost always rooted in perfectly legitimate social concerns. AIDS, economic inequalities, geopolitics, religion and social control. And one of the greatest fears I have is that people will begin to lump all alternative media perspectives, all independent media perspectives, into this kind of broad category of conspiracy nuts. And the proliferation of those theories and the popularity of something like Zeitgeist overwhelming other forms of independent media on the web, for example, is a really disturbing, I think, development and will possibly sort of constrict the media diet of people looking for legitimate information. So I think there's a real concern there.
Ian, I got some more numbers I want to throw your way and then get you to comment on this. In one of the most widely reported and certainly much discussed deaths of the last decade, Princess Diana of Wales. And here's the poll done by the BBC in August of 2006. Did Princess of Wales, Diana, die in an accident? That's the question. Only 43% agree that that's how she died. 31% disagree that it was an accident. 27% don't know. Ian, it's said that people find it impossible to accept that the death of, in the case of Princess Diana, an extraordinary person could happen by such ordinary means, a car accident. Why is that notion so unsettling to so many people?
I think one of the reasons why so few people buy the official story behind Lady Diana's death is that she was a very powerful figure. I mean, she was a member of the royal family, and then when she left the royal family, she was dating a very powerful person. So she lived in this rarefied kind of elite. And when outsiders to that elite view that elite, they imagine that everything that goes on inside that little group is secret, and that the truth never really comes out. So I think that largely accounts for the way this particular event has led to so many conspiracy theories. As we said already in this program, conspiracy theories are all over the place. But I think when you look at this particular story, I think it has a lot to do with the power, the beauty, the wealth that Lady Diana seemed to have access to. And again, it's us on the outside looking in on this story from the outside, and we just do not trust the kind of news we're getting from the people who represent this elite.
Jordan.
Well, you can see obvious similarities, too, between Princess Diana and John Kennedy. I mean, they were young, they were promising, they were outsiders, they were very, very charismatic, and they are involved in very powerful circles. And so when you're closer to the bottom of a power hierarchy and you're looking up, there's perfectly good reason to not know exactly what the limits of that power is, right? How powerful are powerful people? And there's all sorts of conflicting information about that. And it certainly is the case that upon occasion, powerful people conspire to do something that's not appropriate and that is secret. And so then it gets, and this is why it's so easy to sow mistrust in a population. It's like as soon as powerful people do anything that's crooked in a conspiratorial manner, the question of whether or not that's happening all the time behind the scenes immediately manifests itself. And that's really a terrible thing.
Jordan, as you were speaking, we are running on the left-hand side of the screen some footage from November 22nd, 1963. There, of course, we didn't show the actual shot, and here is the Kennedy funeral. 40 years after that assassination, in 2003, the American people were surveyed as to whether or not they believed the official story, the Warren Commission story about JFK's death, or whether they thought there was something else. And Steve, 70% of Americans in 2003, on the 40th anniversary, believed JFK died because of a secret plot. What do you infer from that?
I think what I would infer is that something chaotic, something seemingly sort of random, is intolerable to a lot of people.
Right.
And an agent, an explanation, is an excellent way to relieve those anxieties. It's kind of a tranquilizer, and it seems strange, right, that something like a conspiracy would tranquilize people. But in a way, it does, because it provides reassurance that the culprits have been located, and that culprit wasn't just a single lone deranged gunman, but in fact a much larger system of power. The idea that a single person could do something like that perhaps is more frightening in a strange way than the thought that a large conspiracy could have done something as horrible as assassinating the president.
Tim, can I get your take on that? Is it so difficult or impossible to want to believe that such a, you know, a magnificently large person in every sense of the word could be taken down by such an insignificant nobody like Lee Oswald?
I think that's absolutely part of the dynamic. I think you see that in the 9/11 conspiracy theories. How could 19 rather poorly financed people take down the world's biggest symbol of capitalism? You see it in JFK, you see it in Diana. I also think, though, it's important to look at how difficult it is to know that you know the answer to the JFK situation or any of these theories. It's very difficult for an intelligent and relatively well-read person to get to the bottom of these things. The U.S. Government's first official report on the Kennedy assassination, the Warren Commission report, is 26 volumes long. It's as big as the Encyclopedia Britannica. And so that in itself expresses a kind of uncertainty as to what even counts as evidence in this case. When the government itself can't contain the web of connections and relationships and plots and motives, then you have the breeding ground for the mother of all conspiracy theories. And I think that's part of what's going on in all of these theories. It's very difficult to know how you can really get to the bottom of these things. I think I don't want to suggest that we can't get to the bottom of them. I don't believe that. But it costs a lot of money, and it takes a lot of time and energy and expertise to actually find really solid answers that convince people.
You know, we've talked around the outside of this now for a few minutes, the Kennedy assassination, but I've never actually asked all of you the question directly. Michael, I don't know if you can go to a wide shot here in the studio and whether we can get our other guests out of town. There, perfect. That's the shot I want. Can I see a show of hands as to whether any of you doubt the official version of how John F. Kennedy died? Does anybody believe it was a conspiracy to kill JFK? Hands? Tim, what is this? What are you doing?
I'm saying I don't know.
You don't know?
I mean, I've read and written a lot about that case. I think it's very difficult to know for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you put me on the spot, I'd say I think the lone gunman theory probably holds up in the end, but there's a lot of other stuff there.
Now, do you feel, I mean, you're an academician. You're at a pretty big university,
right,
a pretty respected university in the middle of your country. Do you feel a bit odd saying that?
No. I'm not saying that I think there was a conspiracy. I'm just saying that I think it's hard to know. And that doesn't mean that it's not possible to come up with a reasonable judgment. But I think in a lot of these cases when I'm probably as dismissive as anybody of many of these theories, but what I'm dismissing them on the basis of is usually my trust in the authority of the media, and the authority of academics and experts who I trust to have gone through certain procedures and to tell the truth.
Okay, what about the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission? Do you not trust that?
Well, the Warren Commission report is incredibly ambiguous. I mean, the Select House Committee in 1976, the U.S. Senate, or the U.S., I think it was the Senate Select Committee on Assassinations, found that there was a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you want to trust the government, you're also sort of in trouble because the government has run the matter both ways.
Okay, I got a minute left here. Let me give, I see Jordan wants 30 seconds of it. Nian, I'll give you 30 seconds since you put your hands up too. Briefly, if you would, who killed JFK? Ian.
Me? I suspend my judgment. I really don't know either. I'm skeptical as to what the Warren Commission discovered. I'm skeptical about the lone gunman theory. But I think there's a big difference, Steve, between saying that and then saying that there was a massive government conspiracy to kill the president.
Okay,
so
fair enough.
That to me is different than pure skepticism.
I got you. Last 20 seconds for Jordan.
Well, I'd like to say that if people need a causal model of the world, because if they can't find a cause behind something, they can't control it. And so randomness is more terrifying than causality. And even if you have to hypothesize a malevolent agent, it might be that that gives you the sense that there's at least the potential for control. Whereas if it's just a random event, then there's nothing you can do about it. And people really hate the idea that there's nothing they can do about things.
I know, finally, I'm just going to get emails later tonight about whether or not Ian Dobigan has a relative who's been on this program before. And can I just say, Ian, you're much smarter and better looking than your brother Bruce. Just for the record.
I've always felt that way. Yeah, I felt that way.
Ian Dobigan in University of PEI, Tim Melly, Miami University in Ohio, Steve Bailey, York U, Jordan Peterson, U of T. Thanks, all of you, for being here today on the program.
Thanks.
For more information about tonight's guests, please go to tvo.org. Follow the links to the agenda. Tonight's program was produced by Vodek Schemberg and Naveen Vaswani. And you can read Naveen's thoughts on 9/11 conspiracy theories on our Inside Agenda Producers blog, also online at tvo.org.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin was presented by Vale Inco. Growing together.